Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is going to be an empowering hour on health and nutrition and living a longer life, how a process that we talk about called advanced glycation in products increases the risk of Alzheimer's, and what we can do to reverse that. From Mount Sinai School of Medicine, that information comes. We'll also be talking today at length about saffron. Saffron helps Alzheimer's. This is a brand new research study. Adding fructose drives type 2 diabetes to an epidemic level. That's important to understand. And where do we get that? How we can get off of it? Also, we're going to look about what happens when we start training our brain with music. It really helps us, and how simple jogging is one of the most effective ways, along with power walking, of helping live a longer life. A lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to look at community-owned energy from our environmental segment, how Nebraska became the only state to bring everyone power from a public grid, by Thomas Hanna of Yes Magazine. We'll also be looking at the pollution is the leading cause of death in the developing world by Alex Petru from Triple Pundit. How in the world does pollution exceed malaria and heart disease as the number one killer? But it does. Also from Joe Edwards from Natural News, science had it wrong. Cold weather does make you sick. Therefore, bundling up does protect you, but we'll get into that. Also, I believe that we're going to see a European spring. I believe that because of the courage of the people of Greece, of getting in a government that has said no to austerity and going to reverse a lot of the privatization, that you have much larger economies, mainly Italy, the third largest in there behind Germany, and behind France, but they're deeply in debt, and they have austerity programs, and they're protesting by the hundreds of thousands, and it's not making the news media. So you add in the countries that the population is looking at Greece and saying, well, what about us? Why should we have our pensions stripped out? Why should we have our public in common monuments, parks, water, gas, utilities privatized? So I believe that we're going to see a European spring. It will not be the same as the Egyptian spring or the Tunisian spring, but I don't believe there will be the violence, but it'll be changes, major changes. Now, here's what they don't tell you, and here's what the bankers and the World Bank won't tell you. When you have austerity, when people who thought that they could live comfortably based upon their good work and their skills, off what they're given, not rich, just being able to make ends meet, you take it away. Let's say you take 25% away, which is what they've done in Greece. Well, now you also no longer give them subsidies on things that you used to be able to get at a bargain. You have professors looking in garbage bins for what they can recycle or sell or eat. They haven't had that before. They've had highs and lows, but not like this. So that means you have something new in Greece. Suicide. You have a tremendous increase in suicide directly due to austerity. How do we know? Because the British Medical Journal just published a study of a 30-year analysis of suicide in Greece, and they never had this until 2011. And guess what happened in 2011? Austerity measures. So we will discuss that. A commentary on Malcolm X, he was right about America. Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. My guest in the second part of our program And I'm hopeful this will be very upbeat, because it can be. Living in an age of dire consequences and navigating from a positive perspective the challenges we are facing. And I'll give you an example of how this can work on today's program. So that will be Courtney White from New Mexico, and she's founder and creative director of the Equivera Coalition. That's an alliance dedicated to fostering ecological and economic and social land health through social, responsible, and resilient public and private land stewardship. So we're going to talk about that. So you see, we have a lot to deal with tomorrow. Geoengineering. You've heard about it. Large-scale geoengineering programs that are underway, have been underway. They claim they can help prevent catastrophic global warming. We say you're causing global warming. Your chemtrails, aerial spraying, aerosol emissions, cirrus clouds. This is not helping. This is hurting. We'll expose it tomorrow. And also tomorrow, war is the new normal. Seven deadly reasons why America's wars will persist throughout our entire lives. As you see, we have a lot to deal with. And by the way, on the Progressive Commentary Hour tonight, John Pilger on the World Bank, the most comprehensive analysis of how bad they are. Remember Lawrence Summers? Remember Paul Wolfowitz? Remember all the people who've either been appointed to head the World Bank and where they came from and their background and how wrong they've been on everything they've done? And yet, this is a completely corrupt organization. And we will expose it in its entirety for 1 hour, 7 to 8 o'clock tonight, Progressive Commentary Hour. Let's begin. We just finished with a brain health support group Sunday night. We had an entrance video and an exit video. It was 3 months. And we had about, a 90% compliance, meaning people stuck with the protocols. You would have had to have been there on opening night. The number one complaint was memory loss, depression, and anxiety disorders. So debilitating that people literally didn't have lives. All were on meds, all under doctor's care. Just Sunday night, total transformation. No more depression, no more anxiety, memory keen, coming back, sleeping through the night, energy. I will play these exit testimonies tomorrow. I won't play them all because it was an hour, but I'll play 10 minutes to give you an idea. People who have Alzheimer's and people who have dementia, and in 3 months, what they no longer have. Now, mind you, these are not normal protocols. This isn't having a good diet and having some juice. These are really excessive compared to what people expect, because the disease is very excessive. When someone says, gee, isn't this kind of a radical protocol? And I say, compared to what? Compared to death? No. No, having 13 glasses of juice a day is not excessive compared to death or losing your mind or not being able to function. If I knew I was going blind and I had to, you know, take 40 supplements a day, I'd rather take 40 supplements and keep my vision than to say it's too much of a hassle and go blind. So we will show you what is possible. This was the 44th clinical lifestyle and behavior modification study completed in 40 years. And I think this is going to get people's attention because there were a large number of people and the results were filmed before and after. So we're going to do a split screen and I'm going to post this on the internet so you see before and you see after. And as you will hear, no one's coached. They just get up, give their name, age, what their conditions are, what changed, period. So watch the before on the left-hand side, watch the after. That's after 3 months. So imagine if you got really serious, how much change could happen. This is from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Quote, new study postulates the role of dietary advanced glycation end products in the risk of Alzheimer's. Our new paper, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, provides evidence that cooking foods at high temperatures increases the risk of Alzheimer's disease. This study looked at the content of advanced glycation end products, AGES, in national diets and clinical studies comparing to Alzheimer's disease rates. And then it goes on to talk about, you know, quote, a typical national diets, we have found meat made the highest contribution to age, followed by vegetable oils, cheese, and fish. And so now let's put this in perspective and put it in perspective to the brain support group that we just completed. And the one before that, that we just completed a month earlier, which was also 3 months, and we filmed before and after, on diabetes that we reversed completely. People came in with advanced diabetes, uncontrollable blood sugar levels. One woman had a 700 fasting blood sugar level. We brought it down to 90. No medicine has ever been created that could do that. That's the power. So when your doctor says it's not possible, your doctor is 100% right. It cannot be done with their paradigm. When we say it's possible, we are right because we did it. From my perspective, it's an interesting dynamic. It's like every day of the week you get up and say, my name is Bannister. I'm going to try a four-minute, sub-four-minute mile. And everyone says, you can't do that. And then you go out and do it every day. And then they say either, A, you still can't do it, but we did it. But it's not possible, but we did it. You can't do it. And I, at some point, I hope that the average American is smart enough to realize that virtually everything they're being told, from vaccines to all public health matters, they're being given information from well-intended people who are not looking outside of their paradigm or belief for the truth. And hence, they must be in denial. But if you're on the cutting edge, you benefit. So the first thing people do when they come into a health support group is we tell them there are 7 steps. And everybody starts at the same place, no matter how old or young, no matter what you've done or not done in the past. And here they are. You start by elimination. What does that mean? You eliminate anything that's high heat cooked. That means no more meats of any kind. Nothing from an animal. You don't need it. We explain why. And you got to get out of the French fries and deep fried oils because these create advanced age products, what is called glycation, G-L-Y-C-A-T-I-O-N, glycation. And glycation, and I've given you this example a lot, is you put a plump chicken in and it's plump and moist. You take it out 2 hours later and it's brown and crisp. That's what happens when you eat processed foods or high heat foods, bagels, toast, anything, breads, that's glycation. Hamburgers, hot dogs, french fries, glycation. Pizzas, super glycation. Then alcohol on top of it. So virtually everything that we're eating in America, if you're an average consumer, is harmful. Even when you do have a fruit or vegetable, more often than not, it's genetically engineered, loaded with pesticides. So that's the first thing that changes. Now, when you change that, then you stop harm from occurring, but then in and of itself, the body frequently cannot make the changes necessary to overcome the disease that has occurred because of the extreme inflammation from arthritis to Alzheimer's to Parkinson's to heart disease to cancer. That's where your juices come in. That's where your fruits, your red fruits rejuvenate and change the DNA. Your green vegetables, that is what detoxifies and chelates out the heavy metals and the damage done from that glycation. So by including more fruits and vegetables, by including more fresh juices, by eliminating the sugars, artificial and regular sugars, and processed foods, and going towards this 100% living foods diet, of which 70% is raw and 30% lightly cooked, meaning you have not destroyed the enzymes, you have not created glycation, you've actually liberated nutrients by lightly cooking, like when you lightly cook or steam broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, cabbage, Swiss chard, and Brussels sprouts, you actually increase its bioavailability. you liberate through glycation, or excuse me, through a heat-water combination, you liberate the nutrients. So that's why it's 100% living food, 70% raw, 30% lightly cooked. And then the people start seeing the changes. This is before the exercising and the homeopathics or anything else. So they just said that. They just, orthodox science, just confirmed from its analysis of what we've been saying all along for all these years, all these decades. Imagine how much healthier you would have been had you just paid attention and followed it. Some of you have, and you've seen the results. One more thing here, saffron. Saffron is rarely used in the United States because it's an exotic and very expensive spice. It's probably the world's most expensive spice. It's used in culinary dishes, mainly in India and Pakistan and in the Middle East. But according to the Journal of Clinical Pharmacology and Therapeutics, as well as Psychopharmacology, two very exciting studies, they show that saffron can protect against Alzheimer's disease. Now, mind you, there's no drug that they... We got to get out of the idea that somehow an illusion has more significance than reality. Because someone comes from Harvard, Yale, or some of these other schmuck schools does not mean that these egotists, these narcissists, these corporate whores have any legitimacy in actually what they do. But we stop at the idea of the title, the moniker. We are overwhelmed with being impressed by their degrees and significance in the hierarchical structure of things. And we never look at the results. We get caught into illusion. Presidents, vice presidents, PhDs, MDs, executive directors, lab coats, research facilities, billion-dollar budgets. And we think, my God, they must be doing phenomenal things. We never look at the end result. If we looked at the end result and judge people on the results of what they do, and are we a better place, a safer place, are we honoring life and nature and animals, then 90% to 95% of all that respect and all that deference would evaporate. But that's a separate story. Right now, 30 milligrams of saffron each day in two separate studies for 16 weeks and 22 weeks, two separate studies. At the end of those two studies, it was discovered that the patients who took the daily saffron did better on cognitive memory tests than those who did not take it. Now, the question is, how does it work? Well, saffron is a full-spectrum natural antioxidant herb, and those antioxidants are known to offer some protective benefits against the amyloid plaques that form in the brain of Alzheimer's patients. In addition, this spice also has gallic acid. Gallic is G-A-L-L-I-C, and that supports healthy immune function, which helps to keep those plaques from forming in the first place. And finally, saffron contains a natural compound that has long been known to help memory and protect its benefits. Pyrigal. And P-Y-R, pyra, gala, G-A-L-L-A-L. So the evidence seems to point strongly to the fact that saffron, taken on a daily basis, can protect against Alzheimer's disease, and it may even improve memory during the early stages of the disease. So it's not a cure-all. What we look at is pieces of a puzzle, and that's just one more piece of the puzzle. And finally, if we can do one thing to help all the diabetics, it would be get rid of all fructose in your diet. Now, this is from St. Luke's Mid-American Heart Institute, and this was published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. Quote, clinical experts have challenged current dietary guidelines concerning added sugar consumption in order to tackle, quote, a worsening epidemic of type 2 diabetes. In particular, they identify fructose as a principal driver of type 2 diabetes. Quote, estimated consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages has increased from 10 gallons per person to 50 gallons, 49.3 gallons. And boy, that's a lot. That's a 500% increase. And in the United States, 30 million Americans have full-blown diabetes, and another 60 million have prediabetes. So you're looking at about 100 million, or almost one-third of the population, prediabetic or diabetic, and fructose is right up there. So get on to the healthy juices and get off all of the others, and that will make a difference. By the way, the CDC is saying that most commercial foods for infants and toddlers contain too much salt or sugar. Why? It's for the parents who taste the item. Kids, you can develop whatever you want, and it'll help them. They'll develop natural taste. So if you have them tasting foods in their natural state, they'll develop natural qualities. If you give them artificially sweetened or salted, then that's what they develop. That's a new study from the CDC, published in the journal Pediatrics. 72% of the prepackaged toddler meals assessed were high in sodium, bad, and contained 361 milligrams per serving. That's an astronomical amount. So let's say you get three servings a day. You're at 1,000 milligrams. That exceeds what any baby should be having. Really dangerous. All so that the parents will end up liking what they taste because it matches theirs. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Today I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's a game that I hate to lose. And I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame? Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. In about, I would say, 15 minutes, we'll be talking about living in an age of dire consequences and navigating from a positive mindset the challenges we're facing with Courtney White from New Mexico. But before then, this is the latest on austerity and the consequences, and I'm going to deal with this tonight on my Progressive Commentary Out 7. When we take a look in one country, the Philippines, and you won't believe how much suffering those people go through because of austerity created from the World Bank, dealing originally with the Marcos regime, how he stole money. They knew he was stealing money. He would get billion-dollar contracts. A lot of that went into his personal accounts, and the poor had to pay it back, and they're still paying it back. Even after they paid it back three times, they still have to pay it back, because remember, the World Bank is still a bank, and we're going to expose the World Bank as being one of the most corrupt organizations in history and the suffering it brings. Well, one of the things they do is they create austerity. It's called structural adjustment. This is from Medical News Today, which is interesting, and this is published an article in the British Medical Journal Open. And what it does, it took a look at how many suicides you had. Now, suicide, quote, figures were obtained from national death certificate data from the Hellenic Statistical Authority. A total of 11,505 people committed suicide between 1983 and 2012, and mainly men, 9,079 men and 2,426 women. But here's what's interesting. The vast majority of those occurred after June of 2011, which is when the austerity measures were introduced. And so they make a direct correlation, quote, no other events were associated with such a dramatic shift in reported suicides. Okay, so the next time one of these fascistic Republicans or neocons or corporate Democrats, they're virtually indistinguishable in their actions, when they tell you, you know, well, these country should pay back their debt. What value do they place upon a life? What? And yet, if we were humane, we would forgive all debt. because the people who put us in this predicament were forgiven all their debt and given the ability to create new. And by the way, the number one cause of death in all veterans is suicide. And yet no one talks about that in the media, mainstream media, or the government. You are getting more people killed every day by their own hands. 23 people a day in the military, currently in the military, are killing themselves than all of American casualties in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And you give them the drugs, you increase the likelihood of them killing themselves. Does anyone care? Not a whit. And by the way, science got it wrong. According to Joel Edwards, for years we've been told that getting cold has nothing to do with catching a cold. Turns out science was wrong, and mom's common sense was right. Now, it's a good example of how flawed science can be. The good news is that scientists have finally discovered why colder temperatures can lead to viruses. During cold weather, your nasal passages tend to dry out. Mucus is one of the body's first lines of defense against viruses. Ideally, pathogens become trapped in mucus and are later expelled or are often swallowed or killed in stomach acid. And during cold weather, this is less likely to happen. Why? Because most strains of the rhinovirus, the virus responsible for the common cold, spread through your body more effectively at cooler temperatures. Infected cells often self-destruct. Warm cells in the body are more likely to self-destruct, stopping the virus invasion. Also, warmer cells are more able to muster an effective immune response. Colder temperatures constrict blood vessels, inhibiting the transport of white blood cells to infected areas. In one study, a 4-degree difference in Celsius temperature made nasal cells in mice less able to fend off invading viruses. In another study, cooler temperatures spread viruses from guinea pigs to guinea pig more effectively than in warmer temperatures. And while human beings are not guinea pigs or mice, we are all mammals, and we all get colds. We are all more prone to catch colds at colder temperatures. Cold weather also helps to toughen up the outer shell of a virus so it can survive transport. The virus's outer shell is made up of fat, like substances called lipids, and in cold weather, this lipid outer shell toughens, and higher temperatures, this outer shell softens. Higher temperatures render the virus more vulnerable to the elements. And another factor that shouldn't be overlooked is vitamin D absorption and our tendency to hang out with each other more indoors when it's cold. In the winter months, we are exposed to fewer hours of sunlight during the day and less direct sunlight. And this inhibits our body's ability to manufacture vitamin D, which, as you've heard many times on this program, I've said, vitamin D is essential for your immune defense against viruses. And also during colder weather, people tend to stay in closer proximity to each other in greater numbers. And this proximity helps viruses spread from person to person. So the takeaway message is that your mom was right. Wear your coat, your gloves, your hat, your scarf. Stay toasty warm and don't forget to eat healthy foods, miso soups, probiotic, rich sauerkraut. Have some nice juices, like with always lemon water in the morning with apple cider vinegar and manuka honey and vitamin C. And that'll do the trick. Your immune system will be strong, your body will be strong, and you won't be getting the same amount of colds and flus. Also, there's good news coming in from Nebraska. In the United States, there is one state and only one state where every single resident and business receives electricity from a community-owned institution rather than a for-profit corporation. It is not a famously liberal state like Vermont or Massachusetts. Rather, it is a conservative state, Nebraska. It's two Republican senators and two out of three Republican members of Congress that has embraced the complete socialization of energy distribution. In Nebraska, 121 publicly owned utilities, 10 cooperatives, and 30 public power districts provide electricity to a population of about 1.8 million people. Public and cooperative ownership keeps costs low for the state's consumers. Nebraskans pay one of the lowest rates for electricity in the nation, and revenues are reinvested in infrastructure to ensure reliable and cheap service for years to come. So there are no stockholders, hence there's no profit motive. The electric prices do not include a profit. So that's why they do this. And by the way, payments in lieu of taxes from the state's publicly owned utilities exceed $30 million a year in support of a variety of social services throughout the state, including public television. So if they can do it, and they have, and they're succeeding, and they are, and if it's helping people, and it is, then that means all the other states can use Nebraska as an example. I'll post all the contact information for people who are interested today on my website. And you'll see a lot of posts today, more than, just keep in mind, we post more progressive articles and calls to actions and documentaries than the Huffington Post, Al Jazeera, and the BBC combined every 24 hours. So you got it there. And finally, pollution is the leading cause of death in the developing world. I thought that it was heart disease followed by malaria. It's not. And there's been an extensive investigation from the Global Alliance on Health and Pollution and Columbia University's Earth Institute. And what they found is that it is so devastating. Now, malaria claimed 600,000 lives in 2012, and you start looking at how many people are dying because of pollution. 8.4 million deaths last year. The report is entitled Pollution, the Silent Killer of Millions in Poor Countries. It's three times as many as malaria. So that's a whole lot of people. That's one in seven deaths globally. And 94% of the burden of pollution falls on lower income countries who are the least equipped to deal with the problem. So the 8.4 million pollution-caused deaths in developing countries, air pollution was a leading offender, and 44% of pollution-caused deaths resulted from household air pollution, such as cook stoves that contaminate the air, and 38% were caused by ambient air pollution, including particulate matter from power plants and cars and trucks, and then the contamination of soil and food from heavy metals released by industry and mining accounted for 10%. Also, local water systems polluted by sewage and industrial waste. Cancer, strokes, and heart disease and respiratory disease are just some of the fatal health conditions that can result from this. So the next time you see China and you see how polluted the cities and industrial areas are, and India and how polluted, and the Philippines and Brazil how polluted, just remember that there's a price to pay for all that, the human life. Malcolm X, unlike Martin Luther King, did not believe America had a conscience. For him, there was no great tension between the lofty ideals of the nation, which he said were sham, and the failure to deliver justice to blacks. He, perhaps better than Dr. King, understood the inner workings of empire, though I believe King was moving in that direction and already shown that. Malcolm X had no hope that those who managed empire would ever get in touch with their better selves to build a country free of exploitation and injustice. He argued that from the arrival of the first slave ship to the appearance of vast archipelagos, the prisons, and our squalid urban internal colonies where the poor are trapped and abused, the American empire was unrelentingly hostile to those wretched of the earth. This Malcolm knew would not change until the empire was destroyed. Now, according to Chris Hedges, quote, it is impossible for capitalism to survive, primarily because the system of capitalism needs some blood to suck. That's what Malcolm said. Capitalism used to be like an eagle, but now it's more like a vulture. It used to be strong enough to go and suck anybody's blood, whether they were strong or not. But now it has become more cowardly, like the vulture, and it can only suck the blood of the helpless. As the nations of the world free themselves, then capitalism has less victims, less to suck, and it becomes weaker and weaker. It's only a matter of time, in my opinion, before it will collapse completely, end quote. That was from Malcolm X. King was able to achieve a legal victory through the civil rights movement, portrayed in the new film Selma, which I recommend people see. But he failed to bring about economic justice and thwart the rapacious appetite of the war machine that he was acutely aware was responsible for empire's abuse of the oppressed at home and abroad. And for 50 years after Malcolm X was assassinated in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem by hitmen from the Nation of Islam, it is clear that he, not King, on this issue, was right. We're the nation Malcolm knew us to be. Human beings can be redeemed. Empires cannot. Our refusal to face the truth about empire, our refusal to defy the crimes and atrocities of empire has brought about the nightmare Malcolm predicted. And as the digital age and our post-literate society implant a terrifying historical amnesia, these crimes are erased as swiftly as they are committed. Sometimes I have dared to dream, so said Malcolm, that one day history may even say that my voice, which disturbed the white man's smugness and his arrogance and his complacency, that my voice helped to save America from a grave, possibly even fatal catastrophe. The integration of elites of color, including Barack Obama, in the upper echelons of institutional and political structures has done nothing to blunt the predatory nature of empire. Identity and gender politics. We are about to be sold. A woman president in the form of Hillary Clinton have fostered, as Malcolm understood, fraud and theft by Wall Street, the evisceration of our civil liberties, the misery of an underclass in which half of all public school children live in poverty, the expansion of our imperial wars, and the deep and perhaps fatal exploitation of the ecosystem. And until we heed Malcolm X, until we grapple with the truth about the self-destruction that lies at the heart of empire, the victims at home and abroad will mount. Malcolm, like James Baldwin, understood that only by facing the truth about who we are as members of an imperial people, can we, people of color, along with whites, be liberated? The truth is bitter and painful. It requires an acknowledgement of our capacity for evil, injustice, and exploitation, and it demands repentance. But we cling like giddy children to the lies we tell ourselves about ourselves. We refuse to grow up and become all that we despise. And because of these lies perpetrated across the culture and political spectrum, liberation has not taken place. Empire devours us all. From Malcolm, we are an anti-evil, anti-depression, anti-lynching people also. We can't be anti those things unless you're also anti the oppressor and the lyncher. We can't be anti-slavery and pro-slave master. You can't be anti-crime and pro-criminal. In fact, Mr. Muhammad teaches that if the present generation of whites would study their own race in light of true history, they would be anti-white themselves, end quote. Malcolm once said that had he been a middle-class black who was encouraged to go to law school rather than a poor child in a detention home who dropped out of school at age 15, quote, I would today probably be among the city's professional black bourgeois, sipping cocktails and palming myself off as a community spokesperson for and leader of the suffering black masses, while my primary concern would be to grab a few more crumbs from the groaning board of the two-faced whites with whom they're begging to integrate. Malcolm's family, struggling and poor, was callously ripped apart by state agencies in a pattern that remains unchanged. The courts, substandard schooling, roach-filled apartments, fear, humiliation, despair, poverty, greedy bankers, abusive employers, police, jails, probation officers did their work. Then, as they do now, Malcolm saw racial integration as a politically sterile game, one played by a black middle class anxious to sell its soul as an enabler of empire and capitalism. Quote, from Malcolm. The man who tosses worms in the river isn't necessarily a friend of the fish. All the fish who take him for a friend, who think the worm's got no hook on it, usually end up in the frying pan. He related to the apocalyptic battles of the book of Revelation, where the persecuted rise up and revolt against the wicked. Martin Luther King, quote, doesn't have the revolutionary fire that Malcolm had until the very end of his life, so says Cornel West in his book, Black Prophetic Fire. And by revolutionary fire, I mean understanding the system under which we live, the capitalist system, the imperial tentacles, the American empire, the disregard for life, the willingness to violate law, be it international law or domestic law. Malcolm understood that from every perspective, from early on, and it hit Martin so hard that he does become a revolutionary in his own moral way later in his short life, whereas Malcolm had the revolutionary fire so early in his life. There are three great books on Malcolm X. The autobiography of Malcolm X, as told to Alex Haley, The Death and Life of Malcolm X by Peter Goldman, and Martin and Malcolm in America, Dream or Nightmare by James Cone. Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. So that is for people to consider. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest, who is on hold, and she is Courtney White from New Mexico. Nice to have you with us today, Courtney.
Nice to be here. I'm a guy, not a her. People do that. Yeah, it's all right.
Sorry, I didn't know that.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. Thank you for having me on your show.
My pleasure. You're doing a lot of good. You deserve a forum. One observation I've made regarding many newer grassroots social and health and environmental and alternative education and food organizing and groups is that more often than not, these are being started by parents of growing children. They made the effort to do their homework and have confronted untruths from the major media and the dominant establishment, and they learned to critically think outside of the conventional box, and they arrived at the conclusion that their children's future is being imperiled by rampant neglect of the environment and climate change denialism and industrial monoculture threatening our food security and species extinction and corporate interests that pollute and contaminate just about everything in our lives. Then these parents become motivated to more or less sacrifice their own self-interests and turn their attention to the welfare and well-being of their children, and often an empathetic worry for all of humanity, and confront the forces that are threatening a sustainable future. So I have two questions regarding this that I would like you to begin by addressing. First, can you speak a little about the journey to arrive at a similar realization that if we're going to save and preserve some semblance of sanity and be well-being for our children's future, we need to think ahead and think long-term about the dire consequences of our civilization continuing on its current destructive course of environmental, ecological, and social negligence simply for the sake of profit? Then, second, after we have this realization, how should we speak to our children to convey the threats they may face in the future? And I ask this question because in past generations, parents would focus upon issues such as a good education and studying and working hard and acquiring job skills for their children, preparing them for the future as adults. And of course, even 20, 30 years ago, thinking long-term about the real threats to human survival were not perceived as urgent nor highly probable. Now they are. So how should we speak about these challenges to our children without being too doom and gloom, which we don't want to be, but prepare them for the questionable future they will need to navigate as they get older? The forum is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, the second question first, which is sort of the genesis of the book that I wrote, Age of Consequences, was how do you explain what's going on to your children? I have 16-year-old twins. When I began to research and think about the book, they were 8, and the whole thing was inspired by a story they heard on the radio about polar bears and climate change. And up until that point, we hadn't really thought about how to explain current situations to them. I was sort of hoping not to have to do that right away. They heard the story, asked questions, became anxious, we became anxious, and I became sort of headed down a road thinking about how do you explain kind of the current situation to them. When I was their age, I'm 54 years old, the conservation issues were different, of course. The explanations were different. Some of the same motivations, the rapacious attitude towards natural resources. I come out of the Sierra Club, worked for many years in sort of classical environmental issues, grazing issues, logging, mining, how industry looks at these landscapes, how it chews it up and spits it out. Climate came in later, so there's an extra burden on our kids to try to understand not just the general attitudes of our economy towards our natural resources, but also now the consequences of the same behavior, and that's what the book is about. I tried to answer that question myself first by getting involved with by leaving the Sierra Club and starting my own nonprofit, working with ranchers out here. I live in New Mexico, and I had seen and discovered in conversation with some very progressive land managers some new ideas in land stewardship, how to graze animals in nature's image, for example, the way the bison did. We expanded that eventually to look at local food systems, grass-fed food. We got deeply involved in environmental restoration projects out here. We have a lot of degraded landscapes in the West from historical hard use, some of it industrial, some of it just sort of general poor management. When I was starting out in all of this as a young person, I was concerned and somewhat despairing of the situation. God, what do you do? And I got caught up in a lot of the urban-rural conflict that characterized the environmental movement through the 70s and 80s. Then I met a number of progressive folks doing some very interesting bridge building, some innovative land management ideas, as I said, and we decided to kind of roll them together into this nonprofit. And the idea was that ranchers and environmentalists had more in common than in difference. Once you kind of get down to it, and what was in common was setting our shoulders against an exploitative economic system. And what was very interesting about this was ranchers, as you probably know, are quite politically conservative. Many environmentalists are quite liberal in their political outlook. But you can put all that aside when you're working for a common vision of these landscapes. And this hadn't happened. It wasn't happening when I got started. It was a lot of pushing and shoving about a lot of different kinds of issues, though I suspected that once you got down to it, we can create some common ground here. We call it the radical center, and this is a term that was created by or made up by a rancher, Bill McDonald, down in Arizona.
What does it mean? Give us some specifics now.
Well, in this context, it meant ranchers and conservationists coming together to find practical solutions to common problems. And so it was radical in the sense that the two extremes have spent decades fighting each other in court and in court of public opinion. And it was a radical notion that these two groups, tribes, if you will, could actually find some common ground. That was not in the interest of some leaders of these movements, who wanted to fight and keep fighting. And so this was a grassroots effort generated by a small group of conservationists and ranchers who wanted to stop fighting and try to find some common ground and then get things done. This was a practical, on-the-ground, solution-based approach. It wasn't about sitting in chairs in a circle in a room saying, let's hope we can find some common ground. And they were built around these new innovative land management practices that were coming along, that brought the concerns of conservationists and the concerns of ranchers together in a very interesting way. So it was radical in the sense that we were going to hang up our boxing gloves and find some legitimate, constructive common ground. So it was a centrist in that sense, meaning that it was between these extremes. And then when it got started, everybody kind of shot arrows at us because they didn't want any kind of radical centrism happening between these groups. And so this was, you know, mid-90s, late-90s, early 2000s, when this collaborative movement got started, which I describe in the book. And it was very hopeful. It still is. It's still moving forward. What we didn't think about at the time is climate change. I mean, we didn't think about kind of these larger scale issues that are now pressing down upon us. The time was mostly about grass and soil and animals and food and Western landscapes, a lot of about restoring degraded systems, working together. You know, ranchers own a lot of the West. Half the West is privately owned. If you're worried about wildlife or species, you have to engage private landowners. And you can't do that by pulling out your boxing gloves. You got to work together with folks. So that, you know, that kind of, that was my response to this kind of larger issue of how our economic system treats natural resources and treats each other. You know, again, ranchers are very conservative politically. I'm on the liberal side of this, and yet none of that mattered. It didn't matter. When you got down on the ground and talked about soil and water and grass and food, all that went away, and folks could work together. It was very hopeful. So I've tried over the years to tell my children and other people's children this hopeful message, which is that when you get down to it, ranchers and conservationists have more in common and than difference, and it comes down to the land and the soil and the water, where all things start, frankly. Now, back to the polar bears. So
unfortunately, we don't have time for the polar bears.
Okay.
But what you're doing is important. I believe that it's a completely unique way, in an ecologically, environmentally, and civilized way of understanding how we should be dealing with these stewardships and conservation programs. And I just want to say thank you for being out there and doing this. And we will talk again, because there are other areas I'd like to talk with you about, because you're trying to save the prairies, the farmlands, and the ranches on one side, and I'm trying to get people to give up farming of animals, which would also save the environment and the world we live in. So the question is, how do we go about bringing these two concepts together? And I have some very positive ideas that I'd like to share with you and get your input about how we, you said they're very conservative when it comes to their politics, and but also I know that if we offer the right insights and the right motivation, a lot of these people will give it up, or they'll have to because of a lack of water and them going broke or losing their farm, which I don't want to see. And these are decent people who have to realize we live in a new world today where our resources are not in to be exploited forever. But thank you very much for all that you're doing to help make a difference out there. The book is The Age of Consequences, A Chronicle of Concern and Hope, and the website is QUIVIRACoalition.org. And my guest out there in the West, living in New Mexico, Courtney White. I'm Gary Nall, and we're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time and listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And don't forget, tonight, 7 o'clock, a powerful, powerful hour on the World Bank. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from someone named Susan, and this is a very common question. People are asking you about how to process loss. She says, how do you process the death of a very close friend or family member? I just lost my girlfriend to breast cancer, and I'm just having a really hard time with it.
All of us lose people we care about or creatures we care about. I would look at it from this perspective. There's an old saying, things have a terrible permanence when people die. And what does that mean? It means that for every wonderful moment we shared with someone, it's not going to happen again. Therefore, it has to be within our memory. when someone passes, what's the first thing you think about, Luann?
Well, you feel the pain of the loss, that you're never going to see them or hug them or hold them again.
What you're missing is the collective wonderful moments. And in our friendships, in our relationships, we have stored in our brains so many remarkable moments. And a remarkable moment can just be finding something in common we can laugh about. And that creates oxytocin, and that's a love bond. That's why we love our friends and families and our pets. The things don't have to be super unique. They just have to be something that touches us. So that which touches us also is a permanent energy. It was the writer Jerry Kaczynski. Remember what he said? You don't die in the United States. You become an underachiever. And in the last 30 years, we have made being a normal human being and living a decent and honorable life an underachievement. And therefore, we put our energy into overachieving and overworking, overcompensating at everything. And hence what that did is it left us bereft and short of quality relationships. So we were going to get to that moment where we would go to dinner, have a walk in the park, go do something fun, go on a wilderness quest with a friend. But we didn't get around to it because we made everything else more important. And then we had a whole lot of people who were not mature enough or spiritual enough or balanced enough to have children. So what do? When you don't have a life, have a kid. And so that meant for the next 20 to 30 years of their life, between the kids they have, they didn't have to focus upon their own incompleteness, because it would be a gun goes off and every day you get up and you just go through the day and you just pack as many responsibilities in as you can, thinking redemption through suffering for others. Being responsible for others means I don't have to be responsible for myself. We see this constantly. But we didn't want to talk about that because we don't want anyone to feel bad about the choices they've made. So we just keep enabling them and encouraging them instead of just being frank and honest. There's a consequence to every choice we make. Do we think through the consequences? The idea is most people don't. Only a small percent do. So then one day our friends begin to die or a family member dies. And then instead of having all those wonderful, remarkable moments, we realize how long ago those moments occurred. But initially, the mind doesn't give us a time frame. It just tells us the moment. And then there is this sadness. And this is not a sadness about the person passing. It's more of a self-pity that I no longer have an opportunity to share that because I missed it. The train left the station, and I wasn't there because I had something else that was more important. So what we do in our lives today, we cram our lives. We jam our lives. We clutter our lives. We overstimulate our lives, and we then, when we can't take any more, we sublimate, break it down, and escape into some toxic brew, whether it's marijuana or alcohol, whether it's antipsychotic or antidepressant medication or overeating, watching television, or becoming enamored by gossip and pettiness outside of our lives. Or we become just nothing more than drama queens. And boy, do we have a lot of those. So, the answer is simple. Drop all the balls for a moment and ask yourself, how many do I need to pick back up to have an authentic life? And then how much quality time should I share with the people who are part of my life going forward? Because they too, or you too, one day will pass. And at least you will not have that part of remorse separated from the pain of loss, that you only should have done more and you didn't. We all are in pain when a loved one passes, but we are in less pain and less grief if we know that we really embraced that person in our lives and shared every possible moment we could in a positive way. So then we feel we've had a wonderful gift, and that gift now has gone like a beautiful dove flying away. We had the pleasure of having that in us, that energy. And there's something that we should recall, and that is a husband and wife who love each other deeply, and the husband one day says, I want us both to live to be 100, but I want to live to be one day less than you, because I never want to live a day without you. Appreciate the people in your lives.
I think Winnie the Pooh said that.
Yeah. Take care, Luann. Okay. Let's say hello to Utrice. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Two Detroit stories today. A factory worker walks 21 miles daily to work because there is no bus service, and the politically well-connected reap billions in bankruptcy bounty through court-sanctioned giveaways.
Interesting. We look forward to it. Let's now hear Utrice Lee take on the issues that you won't hear anyone else taking on. And by the way, I got a call last night from a person on the national and local WBAI board who said that Robert Knight, when asked why don't they bring Robert, one of the persons that Robert befriended and interviewed many, many times on his show to a memorial service for Robert that his partner was planning, and this person was attending, and they wanted to bring Noam Chomsky. The Noam Chomsky had to decline because, quote, I've been told by, and you know who, that once you appear on that person's morning radio show, you cannot appear on anyone else's program on BAI.
Oh, well.
Isn't it amazing what comes out and the power and the needs that people have that are so perverse? Utrice Lee right now.